Good morning, diners and travelers. We're hoping that you are recovering from your celebrations, I guess we'll call it, while you listen to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
This time it is 2018, for sure.
And it certainly is 2018. And we have a very interesting program today.
Oh, this is deep.
Pardon?
Deep stuff
deep
today.
Stuff.
Deep stuff today.
Starting with a book that, well, this whole food lab thing, it's just beyond belief. Listen, we're going to be talking to Francisco Magoya, who with Nathan Myhrvold, is working on this food lab, and he wrote this book. We have a 12-page summary, a cheat sheet on modernist bread, and I'm not sure how far we got into it, but listen to us and see.
Modernist bread's about six volumes in and of itself, so,
right.
So there's got to be a big story here, so listen up.
When we've interviewed Francisco Magoya times before, but never since he's been employed at the modernist lab. What is it called? The modernist lab?
Our actual name is the cooking lab, but
yes.
People know us as modernist cuisine, which is really the name of the first book that we published in 2011. So. Either way is fine. Most people know us as modernist cuisine.
Well, your background, what we've interviewed you about in the past, is about baking, because that's pastry and baking and bread are your things.
Right.
But you mentioned about this first book, Modernist Cuisine, which in fact is not really a single book. It's a multiple volume book, as is Modernist Bread, which is what we're talking about today. And the media is lucky to get a cheat slip on this or sheet on this, because it's, here are the numbers. Modernist Bread, by the numbers I'm told, it has 24 plus pages,
2,642 pages.
Right. And it weighs 50 pounds.
Yes.
And the ink itself weighs 4 pounds.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a million words. and all the loaves of bread you baked and putting it together, it's overwhelming. Don't you agree? It's overwhelming. And you worked on it for how many years?
Yeah, a lot of people ask us, well, where do we start? I mean, where do we start? What's the best place to start? So it really depends on, you know, how deep you want to get. I mean, I think the easiest way to get into it is to, you know, what is it that you want to do? Do you want to learn about the history and everything, like, prior to actually making bread? Or is history the most important part to you? I mean, or do you want to just jump into the recipes? Now, I would say that it's not a terrific idea to just jump into the recipes without first reading about, you know, the techniques and reading about the, you know, the how-tos, basically all of the steps that you need to take in order to make good bread. Unless you have some experience, in which case you can just jump into the recipes and you know, get plugging along with that. So, you know, there's many different ways to answer that question. Some people just want to know about sourdough. Some people just want to know about microbiology. You know, one of my favorite chapters is the history chapter, even though I didn't write it. But we have so many recipes there that we replicated from many historical books. I mean, all the way back from Pliny the Elder, you know, from Roman times to Renaissance recipes. And we replicated a bunch of those. You know, some were good, some were not good at all. You know, it was a very interesting lesson in how bread used to be. And, you know, that's one starting point for somebody. But if you wanted to, you know, just get your hands in the dough, so to speak, we would start with volume three, which is all the techniques and equipment. So that's basically your whole how-to volume. And then volumes four and five are all the recipes. It also comes with a kitchen manual, which is, it's a spiral-bound volume where all the recipes can be found, so that you can easily take that into your kitchen and you don't have to take the, you know, beautiful book in and out and get flour, water, oil on it. So the recipe manual is meant to, it's like, it's water resistant, it's portable, so it's like your portable version of the book that you can carry in and out of the kitchen. So.
You know, we get a kick out of looking into an open kitchen and seeing all these volumes lined up on the shelves at the kitchen.
Yeah.
It tells us a lot about the chef.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the size is intimidating to some people, or, you know, you can see it as, you know, this is, oh my God, this is everything I need to know to make bread. But it can also be, to somebody might be like, well, I just want to make some bread. Where do I go? You know, where do I start? So, I mean, it's, what we try to do is we try to break it down so that, people can really just get to where they want to get to. There's a lot of cross-referencing throughout the recipes. So let's say you have, you're not a very experienced baker and you wanted to make, I don't know, let's say, you know, baguette. So within the recipe, there's sections where, you know, for example, the shaping section, if you wanted to learn more about it, would give you a page to go to take a look at the pictures and familiarize yourself with it. So, you know, there's many ways to approach, the book. So, and it's one of those things that it's a book that you don't, I mean, you don't need to read it from start to finish to start making bread. You can skip sections and go back and forth and, you know, kind of like, one of those, like, build your own adventure sort of things.
So yes.
In fact, we have a section that we call that.
Yes.
It's where you can make your own, basically develop your own recipes and your own breads and, you know, just by picking what it is, what characteristics you want in the bread, what type of flour you're going to use, you know, what type of results you're looking for, flavor profile, et cetera. So there's, like I said, there's many different approaches to the book.
Now, are you there for the duration? I mean, is your baking career over, except to the extent that it's in the lab?
No, fortunately, Nathan wants to write a bunch more books, and fortunately, they happen to be within my area of expertise.
Good.
So yes, I'm fortunately, this really is the best job I've ever had, hands down. So.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah.
So people like Bill Gates will get a different kind of gift they can give to their wife for Christmas. That's for the person who has everything.
Yes, exactly. That's one way to put it, sure. So,
this. I mean, what do you love most about it? The surprises, the luxury of following your curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's if people are reading it to learn, it serves that purpose, but it also, like you said, it's like if you have just the curiosity to learn more about the subject and to really, you know, maybe there's a question you had about bread that you've never been able to answer before, or nobody really knows the answer to. It's likely that we might have the answer in the book. So that's part of what is great about this particular volume, or set of volumes, if you will.
Now, what was it? What were some of the things that you discovered? I mean, you'd been a professional baker for a long time, but I'm sure, like many people would say, but I didn't know everything.
Right.
Now, what were some of the things you found out that you didn't know before?
Well, you know, there's with bread, there's a lot of mythology, and there's a lot of, I would say, things that are done because they're done out of tradition, or because you know, they've been done the same way for many years, and so people don't like to change those things very much, or there's a lot of stories that people really love. Like, for example, if we talk about bagels. You know, one thing that we really didn't buy is that you can only make good bagels in New York City.
Because of the water, they say.
Because of the water, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a good story. It's a good story because it's like I go to New York and let's say you're not from there and you want to have a really good bagel and you've heard so much about New York City bagels. So it makes for a great experience to have these New York City bagels. But the truth is that, I mean, I used to live in New York City, and I also used to get bad bagels in New York City. So,
sure.
I mean, how would you explain that, right? And so, yes, a lot of people say, well, it's the water. But the thing about the water is that if that were true, then all of the breads that are made in New York City would have that bagel-like characteristic, right? They would have that sort of particular chew that you only get from bagels. It would have that, you know, that density and so on and so forth. And that's not exactly the case with many artisan breads that you get in New York City. So what we did is we put it to the test. We had somebody actually get us tap water from New York City, and they shipped it to us. And what we did is we made a number of bagels with New York City tap water. We even boiled them in New York City tap water just to make sure that, you know, everything that the bagels came in contact with had this, like, New York City water, you know, thing attached to them. So we also did a side-by-side utilizing our water from, you know, Seattle. So we made bagels, and then we had a bunch of people, not just from Seattle, but also, you know, people who had lived in New York City. You know, we did a blind test, and nobody could tell the difference. And so it really was just for us to confirm the fact that it's not the water in and of itself. It's the method and the technique that you utilize to make the bread. There are other folks that say in Naples that will say, well, you can only make good pizza in Naples because the water in Naples has got, you know, it's from Mount Vesuvius and all the minerals that are in it and so on and so forth. But, I mean, I've had fantastic pizzas, you know, yes, in Naples, but also in San Francisco and New York City and even Phoenix, Arizona. So it's a story. It's not exactly science that backs up any of this information that, you know, I hate to say this, but it doesn't hold any water. It's the best way to tell it.
That's nice. Now, what's the name of that French guy who everybody thinks makes absolutely the world's greatest baguette?
Oh, yeah, what's
starts with a P?
Oh, Poulain?
Poulain.
Yeah, he makes a country bread. He makes a really good bread, and he was, well, he used to. He passed away in
He died. His daughter's running it now.
His daughter.
That's a pretty careless excuse for getting out of making baguettes.
The bread he's most known for is a country loaf that he developed, and it was kind of like a reaction towards industrialization of bread, and so he started making this country style loaf. He calls them miches. And so they're it's fantastic bread, and I don't think they've ever changed the formula. They continue to make the same formula. And actually, Apollonia, who's his daughter, she basically took over the reins of the company when her father passed away. And she was 18 when that happened. She was still in college, and, you know, she's been in charge of she's the CEO of a company. So
yeah. She's a gutsy lady.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do an excellent job. So, you know, to answer your question, that was just some of the things we found out. There's a lot of people that like to utilize fruit water for their sourdough starters. But we tested that. We put that really through the ringer because yeast is a very specialized microorganism. There's many different kinds of yeasts everywhere. Basically, if we kind of kid around that if yeast was a virus, we'd all be dead. That's how prevalent it is everywhere. And so
that's why I never understand how you can cure things when you don't know what's flying around out there.
Right, exactly. And the thing about yeast is that yeast lives in a place where it can eat the particular sugars that thing has. So, the, you know, like when you get grapes and they have that, like, white...
Right.
Yeah, that's yeast, but that yeast likes to eat the sugar that's in those grapes. The yeast that you find in wheat lives on the wheat because it likes the sugar that that is found in the wheat. So, in reality, to get a sourdough starter, all you need is water and flour. You don't need to, you know, have raisin water or fruit water to get it going because, again, the yeast that is living in that raisin or that raisin water is going to want those sugars. So when it runs out of those sugars, it's basically going to starve to death. So
well, we can't have that, right?
Yes.
I can't have those little yeasty boys starving, my
yes,
goodness.
Yes, the yeasty boys. Mm-hmm,
well, exactly. Is it we interviewed recently Jim Leahy, I think.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, and was he the one who suggested rubbing a kale leaf over something? Something having to do with rubbing something from a kale leaf, you know, that gets that white powdery stuff on it.
Yeah, I mean, that white powdery stuff is basically the yeast.
Yeah.
But again, there's many different species of yeast, and that's where the distinction lies, and as to wherever it lives is what it's going to eat.
I thought it was called Fleischmann's, and it came in a yellow box.
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's actually what Fleischmann's does, and all these other companies, they've known how to harvest that particular strain of yeast and basically produce it in large amounts so that they can sell it for people to make bread. So it's interesting how trainable yeast is. You know, I mean, if we talk about, you know, sourdough starters, you have yeast, when you feed it, it knows how long it has before it starts running out of food. So if you feed your starter every 24 hours, what happens is the yeast, the yeast that are in there have been basically programmed themselves to know that, okay, we need to make this food last for 24 hours.
Well, you're sounding like it has a mind.
You know, it doesn't really have a mind, but it has adaptability. And that is what is pretty incredible about yeast, is that it can adapt to many circumstances. And you can force that adaptation, meaning if I want to have really sour sourdough starters, what I would do is I would feed my yeast every 36 hours. Because the older my starter is, the more acidic it's going to be. So it'll know to make the food last for 36 hours. But then if I want, you know, to feed it every 12 hours, I have a much milder sourdough starter, it'll know that, okay, I'm going to be fed every X amount of time. And so it's a single cell organism, but once it learns to adapt, it's pretty remarkable, all of the things that you could do with it. So it's almost, like you said, it's almost like it has a mind of its own, but it doesn't. So
don't you get...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I can come back to my thought.
Well, it's what it is basically survival of the fittest. And so, you know, that part of what is important to realize about that, too, is that, you know, when these sourdough starters are handed down from, you know, one person to another and so on and so forth, there's emotional attachment connected to it because, you know, some people hold on to their starters. You know, I've heard of people that have been in their family for 100 years. And the problem with that is because yeast is so adaptable is that if I take that starter and I just take it even across the street to my house, there's a different set of combination of lactic acid bacteria and yeast, and it's going to take over whatever was in that jar of 100-year-old starter. And that is what we talk about when we say survival of the fittest. Whatever the largest numbers are in that environment are going to basically eliminate whatever's in smaller numbers. So the problem is that there is a lot of romanticism attached to these, like, really old starters, but in reality, unless it stays in the same place for, like, that whole 100 years, and you feed it the same type of flour for the whole 100 years, and it's like you have this, like, super disciplined way of maintaining it, it's going to change and evolve and become something different. So
that might be what happened to my yogurt starter that came from Syria, and it was, I don't know how many hundreds of years in a family. And it was fine until I gave it to a neighbor to take care of while I was traveling, and it died.
Well, she forgot to feed it, right?
I don't know.
That could also be a part of the problem. If, you know, it needs food, and if we don't give it food, it's going to die. Like, it's like any living thing, basically. So.
It's amazing. Were you a scientist before you were a baker? Is that asking a stupid question?
No, not at all. I mean, what I learned early on in my career is that in order to make better food, it wasn't necessary to just look at a recipe. What you had to do is understand how things work, how the ingredients react with each other, how they function, how they can be harnessed, how to make them, you know, basically do what you want them to do versus, you know, vice versa. And so, I started to develop a keen interest in the science of things and how they work, and basically a lot of that information doesn't exist in books that you could easily buy at, like, Barnes & Noble. So you have to do a lot of legwork to find publications. It's basically academic papers that discuss, you know, the ingredient functionality and microbiology and all these things. And so I basically taught myself how to, you know, understand the scientific language, because it's very different. It's very different from regular writing, as you know. It's meant for scientists, not for lay people. So it took me a while to understand, you know, texts, because they were so complicated, but eventually I came to the point where I was comfortable enough understanding them. And so applying that sort of knowledge to, you know, making pastry cream or making, you know, sourdough or making pâte à choux or all of these things, it's almost, I don't want to say it's magic, because it's not, but it seems magical, the results that understanding things at a scientific level, how it does improve your cooking and how it improves whatever it is that you're trying to do, it'll make it so much better. And so that was really what we wanted to do with our book, with Modernist Bread and Modernist Cuisine, is to do, almost act as translators of this sort of language, so that everybody can understand it without dumbing it down, because that's important. I mean, people are smart, but not everybody's a scientist. And so what you have to do is almost translate into, you know, from one language to another and make it understandable so that people can take advantage of it, and improve, you know, whatever food they're cooking or whatever interest they have in a particular ingredient and so on and so forth. So that is one of our primary goals.
So you think that you've discovered things in the research for this Modernist Bread project that we will look towards a future of better bread?
Yeah, we certainly hope so. I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia with how bread used to be better in the past, and how, you know, we need to make bread the way our ancestors used to do it. And part of what we learned when we replicated a lot of these historical recipes is that bread in the past, it's not that it was bad, but it's very different from the bread that we have now. Meaning it was very dense. It was bread that was meant to sustain you and nourish you and fill you up. So it was, you know, the bread that we have now, which is like nice and light and crusty and it has big open holes, that was unheard of, you know, until possibly the late 1800s, actually. So, you know, bread was also meant to last a long period of time, because if I was going to go on a boat somewhere and be on a boat for months, I needed to be able to make a loaf of bread that was going to last me for that long period of time without going bad. And so imagine what that meant for how the bread had to be made so that it would last so long and be able to not stale. And so it wasn't better in the past. What we firmly believe is that better bread is to come in the future, because we have more people that are interested in making bread now and interested in the quality of the wheat that they're utilizing, and we have better equipment. I mean, simply talking about how bakers used to be treated and the sort of working conditions they had, it was brutal. I mean, there's many descriptions of bakers, you know, working late at night in the basement somewhere, and they had to make so much dough that they had to utilize their entire bodies to mix the dough. So it was really hard work, and it was very unsanitary work, right? I mean, if we're talking about utilizing your entire body and sweating into the dough, I mean, think about what that meant for sanitary conditions, not just for the bakers, but for the people who would eat the bread.
Good grief, that's disgusting.
It is disgusting, and so whenever anybody says, like, oh, we need to go back to how bread used to be in the past, I mean, when you just remind them that it didn't used to be better and that conditions for bakers were truly brutal, you know, people hopefully will change their mind. I think that we have access to such great equipment and such great flour these days that, you know, we're looking to the future for bread and not into the past. So,
wow. I mean, it's like, I can't even get my head around this.
This man is a thinking man's baker.
Yeah, I should say.
Yes, that's what we tried to accomplish.
I would like to talk to you all day, but I realize I can't tie you up, because I'm sure you have a problem you're solving today.
Every day.
every day, and there'll be a new one tomorrow.
Yes. Well, and that's how we stay employed, which is great.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, Francisco, I've loved the answers to all these questions that you pose.
I think modernist baking is in good hands, shall we?
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It was really great talking with both of you.
Thanks, Francisco.
All right, thank you. Bye.
And if you think that was a deep story, wait till you hear the next one. So don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
As I said, I think Prince Charles, first in the line to the British throne, has a certain amount of clout in our family, our household. And when we found out he was interested in a new project, Crops for the Future, and an organization called Forgotten Foods Network, we jumped on the phone to Malaysia. Our time, 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard, and Professor Syed Assam Al's time, 8:30 p.m.
Yeah, I think he just had dinner.
And we just had breakfast.
But listeners, seriously, this is what he's dealing with is really important stuff.
Yes, it is.
You got to pay attention. We need people to pay attention to just these kinds of things, and that's why we're bringing it to you today. Welcome, Professor. You're joining us, and I haven't even had my breakfast yet.
But I'm on a Friday evening in Kuala Lumpur, and it's 8:30. There
we go. So clearly there was a good reason why we got up early this morning, and you're still up. Although I guess you probably haven't had dinner yet anyway.
I've just finished.
You've just finished dinner. Okay. So we're talking today about something that reached our attention through the unusual persona of Prince Charles, the Duke of Cornwall and the Prince of Wales and all that stuff, who's always been very interested in things agricultural. But what was it that attracted his attention? What are the two? There are two organizations here, and how they interact is a little confusing to me.
Two organizations would be Crops for the Future and the Forgotten Food Network, which is not actually an organization. It's an initiative. So if I can take you back a couple of steps, and they're ones that I think everybody should be interested in and certainly should be concerned about, which is in the last, 100 years or so, less than that, we have completely transformed our food system. And what we've done is we've focused on the big crops. We've focused on those crops that actually produce high yields. You know, they can be mechanized. They can produce, yields in good conditions, lots of fertilizer, irrigation, pesticides, herbicides. And, of course, those crops are great crops. I don't dispute any of that. But the direction we've moved in is towards making those crops the crops that we actually entirely depend on. And if I give you statistics, which I don't want to spend all this interview telling you about numbers, but one number I would like you to think about is four crops, wheat, rice, maize, and soybean, now provide more than 70% of the world's food.
Right, and we're moving towards monoculture.
Well, monoculture is a separate issue. Monoculture is growing a crop in the field, on its own. What I'm more concerned about is these four crops dominate everything everywhere. In other words, whilst they're fantastic crops, we depend on them. 7.5 billion people depend on them for 70% of our food. So we're now in a position where those four crops have to feed more and more people. And they have to feed them in lots of places. So we grow them in one place, we take them in long supply chains, and we take them somewhere else. If something happened to any of those crops, all of us suffer because we've actually reduced or removed or marginalized all the other crops, essentially, that have provided food for most of, our human history. So the risk of four crops feeding the world is itself self-evident to me, but it's not evident to everybody because we're not aware that just four crops are so dominant in the agricultural system and the food systems of the planet.
What could happen?
Now, you might say...
What could happen?
Well, anything could happen. If I just say to you, imagine, I can't tell you anything could happen, but I could tell you if something happened. If something happened to one crop, you're taking out a huge percentage of the food that people eat around the world. If something happened to one of those crops, and we're just 7.5 billion people, and it didn't change, the climate was the same, we'd say, well, okay, that's no problem. You know, we can somehow find, you know, improvements. We can get new varieties. We can improve the production. My concern is we're going to have 9.5 billion people, not 7.5, and we're going to be in a hotter world.
Yep.
And my concern is if those four crops don't feed 9.5 billion people on a 3-degree hotter planet, what have we done to look at the alternatives? So it's a very straightforward question. If we don't have a plan B, and there's no planet B, so we can't go anywhere else, those four crops are going to have to deliver huge amounts of food for lots of people. And that, to me, is a risk.
Yes, so
we add, and I won't go, I just want to add two points. One is the four crops don't just feed us, they feed our animals. In other words, we use them for animal feed, and that's another question. Why do we use human food crops to feed animals? And, of course, they feed our engines because we use them for biofuel. So we're putting these amazingly, you know, successful and significant crops into a position where the pressure on them is greater than our confidence that they can deliver.
Now, you say on one of the things I saw on your website that one of the issues that you're worried about, which you just referred to along the way without really emphasizing it, is that the climate condition, global warming, whatever word you like to use to describe it, is a very evident threat already. Because of the environment that these core crops require is in itself is disappearing.
What is happening, and of course almost every country, in fact all countries but one, as you know, have recognized climate change is reality. I'm not going to say that you know the story.
Yeah, we know.
So the fact is, climate change isn't something in the future. It's not a long way away. It's not even a question. We are feeling climate change. We experience it. The thing that we have not recognized is climate change isn't just the temperature getting hotter, which is a big issue. It's going to get more volatile, and we can feel that. The seasons change, the amplitude, the variability of climates means that the big four crops that grew up and we looked after them for a long time in good conditions, in benign environments, they're going to have to work in very much more volatile and much more hostile environments, and that is a very significant issue because whilst we know that we can provide lots of inputs to those crops, the environments in which they're going to have to grow in, we're going to have to provide even more inputs, we're going to have to put more and more resources in, and large areas of the world simply won't be able to support those big four crops. That's the first issue.
If I can say that just a little bit differently.
Please do.
What you're saying is that, if you like, the risk of a failed harvest is much, much higher.
Yeah. It's much higher, and it's much more, it happens in lots of parts of the world. In other words, one failed harvest in Canada or USA or Australia affects people in Africa and India and China because we're importing food. Of course, we're taking food from one place to another. Therefore, it isn't just our local crop. It's our global crop that's actually going to affect, lots of people.
Yes. Yeah.
The other thing which is breaking, I don't say breaking news, but it's very, very significant, and we're only just discovering this, is that the nutritional content of big crops decreases under climate change. So what we're finding, and this is really, cutting-edge science, is when we fumigate fields with carbon dioxide, when we do experiments, in real conditions, in actual field crops, and we put CO2 into the atmosphere, what we see is a reduction in the micronutrient content of the big crops.
That's
zinc,
awful.
Iron. And for that, we have only just discovered that not only does the food and therefore the yield of these crops decrease or become more volatile, more difficult to manage, but their nutritional content goes down. And that is critical, because when people depend on those crops for their nutrition and the nutrient content's going down, just imagine how much we're going to have to eat of those crops simply to provide enough nutrients for us.
It's horrifying, isn't it, when you put it that
okay,
in that level.
So we figured that part out. That was the easy part. Now the hard part is what we do about it, and I guess that's where the other acronym comes in.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely right. We... First of all, Crops of the Future is a world-first international center looking at those crops that we have considered to be marginal, alternative, what we call underutilized. In other words, the big crops have all had a home, they've all had a center, they've all had investment, and good reason. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't invest in the big crops. However, we haven't till now had a center that looks at all those alternative crops, and there are hundreds, thousands of those crops. We, as a center, have an enormous responsibility. We are a center to look at these alternative crops and to see what their potential is. Now not just now, but of course in Climates of the Future.
You are director of this Crops for the Future?
That's Crops for the Future. And Crops for the Future is a global organization, but it's hosted in Malaysia with enormous support from the government of Malaysia, which has made enormous investment in it, as has the University of Nottingham. So it is whilst it's a company, it has the guarantee of the government of Malaysia and the University of Nottingham. And we have made partners around the world, because it's not going to happen in Malaysia in one country for all these alternative crops. We've got to find partners and collaborators and investors who see the potential of these crops in different climates, in different conditions, with different crops, of course. There's thousands of these crops, and we can't just all work on all those crops in one place. So that is basically what Crops of the Future is. It's a global alliance, this global international network looking at crops that we have really ignored for the last 20, 30, 50, 100 years, but they have been around throughout human history, but have been marginalized and disregarded by modern science and the agri-food industry.
Can you give us
Crops of the Future.
Can you give us a couple of examples? I mean, what are these foods? Are they potatoes? Are they carrots?
Sure.
Are they what
no.
are they?
No, they are, because they're all big crops. I'll give you an example that I've worked on, and the reason why I got interested in these crops is I went to work in Africa. I went to work there as a scientist, and I was looking at what I was asked to do, which was to look at the big crops. What I noticed was that local farmers, particularly women, were growing their own crops. They were growing crops that we ignored. They said, we were told, well, these crops are no use. I mean, if they were any good, we'd have discovered them by now. These are the crops that African farmers were conserving and looking after for thousands of years, but mostly in their backyard, mostly women, mostly marginal, mostly in difficult conditions. One crop, Bambara groundnut, was a crop that I saw over and over again throughout sub-Saharan Africa, and I saw it being grown by women farmers to feed their family when the big crops, the maize and the crops that their husbands were seeing as their, the crop, sort of the big crop, the international crop that they were growing. Those crops failed, and the women had to feed their family on crops such as Bambara groundnut, which is drought resistant, it's nutritious, it grows in poor conditions, but it will never have the massive yields that the big crops had under good conditions. So Bambara groundnut then became a crop that I got fascinated with, and we've spent a lot of time looking at this crop to find out why has it been ignored, what is the potential, what can we do with it, and we found it's got enormous potential because it's grown in many, many parts of the world. It's not just an African crop. It's actually grown in Southeast Asia. It's even grown in Malaysia. And because we've never looked at it, it's been around for a long time without support, without evidence, without international research effort. And that's a crop that we've spent a great deal of time and effort on because it will grow in these very marginal conditions and it's nutritious. And we really have to give it back to the people who've protected it for generations and say, here's a better version of the crop that you've looked after for so long. Here's some products. Here's some uses. Why don't we make this a crop that you could actually grow and get commercial benefit from them rather than just feed your family?
This reminds me of the third plate, Dan Barber's book.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
He identified...
Absolutely.
Old form of wheat that has been being revived a bit through his efforts.
Yeah. Now, that's a related issue. Should we, shouldn't we go back to the ancient varieties and ancestors of wheat and maize and soya and other crops that we're familiar with? That's an important job to do, and I don't have a problem with that. That's not our job.
Okay.
Our job is to look at those other crops, because the other crops have themselves been not, there's no major research effort on Bambara groundnut till now. But there's huge numbers of land races, farmers' own land races that we can actually select and improve and make.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I mean, since I deal with food all the time, that's kind of unusual that I have never heard of it.
Can you give us an example?
It will be very interesting if, you know, the peanut, which you are familiar with, of course, and Americans have got a great affection for peanut butter. Peanut is a crop that originated in Central America, and it was taken from Central America to other parts of the world, particularly Africa, and it displaced the local African groundnut. So when we say peanut in English usage is called groundnut, and groundnut was brought to Africa, but Bambara groundnut was the local African peanut, if you like.
I see.
And that was the one that got displaced because it wasn't high in oil.
I see.
The problem with Bambara groundnut is it's fully nutritious, it's very resilient, it grows in poor conditions, but it can't sell huge amounts of oil because its oil content is very low, and peanut, of course, has a very high oil content, and therefore edible oil from peanut became a commercial driver. Now we might look at Bambara groundnut completely differently and say, actually, it's got very little oil. That's very nutritious. You know, it's got protein, and it's very good for you, and it doesn't have high fat content.
Can you think of anything?
We started and people started bringing peanut to Africa, it displaced the local African peanut, which was Bambara groundnut.
Professor, okay. can you think of an example of a food crop like this that would grow like in the United States or in a European country?
Well, first of all, Bambara groundnut will grow in the United States, and I bet, if you actually go to the website, you'll find Believe in Bambara, there's actually an organization in America looking at Bambara groundnut. But if you actually look at diaspora, if you look at populations that have moved around the world, people must have taken Bambara from Africa to America in history. So that's one point.
Lead us into what captured Prince Charles's attention and what is this initiative he's launching?
So the second question you asked, one is the organization Crops of the Future. The other is, how do we capture the interest of the public in these obscure and underutilized crops that they themselves have not heard of very much? And what we set up, which was actually with the endorsement of the Director General of the FAO, Dr. Graziano da Silva, he said he would propose a United Nations year of forgotten foods.
Okay.
And he said, if you could get your forgotten crops to support forgotten foods, that would be fantastic. Let's make a case for a United Nations year to actually celebrate forgotten foods. And we took that initiative, we took that request, and we said, why don't we set up a forgotten foods network and actually ask people to do one thing as a minimum, two things as a maximum. One, give us your recipes of the foods that you remember from your past, that you no longer eat, you no longer see, you no longer find in supermarkets. And what we did was we talked to as many people as possible and said, have you got a food from your past that you can remember that we no longer eat? Give us your recipe of that food. And that was how we started the Forgotten Foods Network. It's basically just give us the narrative and the history and the background, but tell us about a food that you no longer eat. Now, the interesting that really captured the interest of so many people, including His Royal Highness, because everybody's got a forgotten food in our history, haven't we? You know, we've all come from somewhere, we've all got backgrounds, we've got families, we've got mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers who all used to do something that we no longer experience, we no longer have that food, and we cherish that. So when we actually go back to our culinary history, we can remember those foods, and our job is to, as a minimum, collect the recipe of those foods that no longer get eaten, but people remember them from their past. And our job as a research organization is to do research on those foods. So it's all right to collect the recipe. That's very useful. But what about the content? What about the nutritional content? What about what's good or bad about those foods? They might be forgotten for a reason. You know, they weren't very good for you. But
who's going to do that?
Well,
go ahead.
So our job is to investigate those foods, recreate them, and improve them if they need to be improved. But the critical issue is these are forgotten foods that we will need to feed the future. If you remember what I said before, these four crops will not be enough to feed the planet.
Right.
We've got to look at other crops. Those are the crops that we've ignored that will actually be around when the climate becomes much more difficult, much more hostile. Those are the crops that we've got to find foods from. And the best place to look for those foods is what did we do with them in the past. And that's our job.
Now, something's happening in April. What is that?
Something's happening in April. I'm not sure what
there
will be events with next year. Sorry?
I said some sort of a conference, a global gathering of some sort?
We would love to have next year a festival of forgotten foods. What we've got is two steps. One is the Director General and the Food and Agriculture Organization saying we should have an international year of forgotten foods. That's up to the individual member countries. We can't announce the international year. We can announce an international festival. What we want to have next year in Malaysia is to ask people to bring their forgotten foods to a festival and celebrate those foods. Bring their celebrity chefs and their cultures and traditions, and bring them all to showcase the foods that they cherish from their past, but people actually don't see anymore outside those local communities that still conserve them. If we could have that festival, we think that would generate global interest in these forgotten foods.
And what about the contact?
A great deal of support.
How about a contact information for this?
Well, I think we could put all of that in. It's all a discussion, to be honest. At this stage, we want to get this Forgotten Foods Network out there so people actually give us their recipes and share their recipes, and then we give the recipes back to them and say, this is what your recipe contains. This is what we could do. We could put a new ingredient in that would make it just that bit, you know, tastier or just that bit more nutritious. Once we collect the recipes, we will go back and ask everybody who's donated those recipes to say, now, shouldn't we really be looking at those recipes as becoming part of our diet? Shouldn't we be diversifying diets? Because at the moment, not only do we eat very, very few crops, plants that we actually depend on, our diets are so narrow that they depend on just these major crops from almost all of our food now. And we've realized now that diversifying the diet is actually the big change that we're going to have to look at in the future. We can't depend on just those four crops, not just because they might not be around, because the crops themselves won't be able to sustain us, but narrow diets are not good for our health, and I'm sure you're aware of that. And the big crops will not produce the diet that we need to diversify what we actually consume, that we need in the future.
How much work there is.
Need ingredients.
How much work lays ahead of you is just mind-boggling.
I know all about the challenge, but we won't. What can I ask you? What the alternative is? Because if we don't do that,
everybody's
and we don't get it right, the four crops we've got to change. What we've announced and something which again we've taken an initiative in is we've proposed a global action plan for agricultural diversification. Global Action Plan for Agricultural Diversification, GAPAD. What we've proposed is to bring everybody who's interested in agricultural diversification together and address the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals by demonstrating agricultural diversification. If we can do that, we can transform agriculture for good. And that's our, you know, we're incredibly ambitious because we have
yes.
to be. Not because we think we've got all the answers. It's just we have to be ambitious because the global food system is not going to, you know, it's creaking at the moment. And if it's broken, we all suffer because we all eat. We all depend on agriculture. And we need to transform agriculture for good and get away from the yield for profit model that we've been fixated on for so long. Sure. And it's not just us. We're just proposing that to build a critical mass of interest to see that food is not just about, you know, putting fuel in our bellies. It's actually culture and tradition and all the other things, and particularly nutrition.
Well, Professor Syed Azam Ali, I'm not going to let you keep me away from my breakfast very much longer, because I'm eating a healthy diet of fresh fruit of the season. I need to go back to that, but I'm so glad that our paths crossed. People want to find out more. There's a website, cffresearch.org, where there's lots and lots of information. and lots of pictures. And I'm so glad you're out there.
Yes, I agree.
I wish that the Pennsylvania State University here in the United States was part of what you were doing, but maybe at some point they will be. And
I hope they will. This is an opportunity for all of us to work together. Thank you so much for asking me to speak to you.
Well, thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, listeners around the world, we've given you some heavy-duty stuff today. How about something a little bit lighter, more entertaining to end the program?
Yeah, I'm not so sure exactly how this fits into our program today. But we like Mitch a lot. We like his product. So who we're going to be talking to is Mitch Berliner of Meat Crafters, and who makes skinny salamis. Put that into the program.
Yeah, go figure. Trust me, you'll enjoy it. The man's eaten them all already. I guess if you invent skinny salamis, certainly blaze the trail. Mitch Berliner. Mitch, you and I have one thing in common, which we didn't mention before we came on the air, but I'm sure you won't mind. I think we've both pitched in the same category of old farts.
That is correct. I describe myself as that all the time.
And neither of us can retire, because far too interested in being busy.
Hyper.
But you have a lifetime that tops mine by several orders of magnitude. Why don't you tell us the story? Begin at the beginning.
Well, thanks for having me on your show today. Really appreciate that. And my story is pretty simple. I went to college in the Washington, D.C. area, had a degree from American University at the business school in computers, and I didn't like it. So I never got a single job in that field, and I taught school for a couple of years, and then I always loved food. It was very important in our home. My mom and dad cooked, which was kind of unusual in the 1950s and 60s, and they taught myself and my brother to cook, and so we had food. And so I always worked in the food business, working my way through college. Right out of college, while I was teaching, I got a job as a school teacher. At the same time, I started on the weekends a gourmet-to-go place at a farmer's market in Bethesda, Maryland. And that led to opening up four additional farmer's markets in the Montgomery County area, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C., and that led to a distribution business where we introduced Häagen-Dazs ice cream, Ben & Jerry's, Dove bars, and all kinds of specialty, organic, and other kinds of frozen specialty foods in the Mid-Atlantic area.
Now, salumi is not exactly a straight pathway from ice cream. So there was something else that tripped you in that direction, and then you really got organized.
Indeed. So after we sold our second distribution business, I always had an interest in making salamis. We had been to Italy numbers of times, and of course that's salami central, and really thought that that would be something fun and interesting, and no one, even to this day, has a USDA license to craft salamis in the metro Washington area.
That seems odd. It's really strange, but you know, I can't think of any. I couldn't name any.
But you got a license, but you also did something different. You created these skinny things. I mean, where did that idea come from? The Italians would probably throw you out of the country if they knew what you were doing.
Well, what happened with the skinny salamis particularly, and that's the product that we're really going national with, is if you or your listeners are aware, there's a tremendous interest in the high-protein snacks and the growth in the last 5-8 years of jerkies and other kinds of smoked products, etc., has been pretty phenomenal. And so we decided Well, no one's making a meat snack that's actually a real salami. They're all kind of cooked products. Jerky's are dehydrated. Other products are cooked or smoked. But no one was making a salami.
Yeah, it's slow-cured. It's cured rather than cooked.
Exactly. Ours is a two-part process. That's the way a traditional salami is made, whether it's a skinny salami or a larger format, and that it's fermented first in special chambers, and then it's cured, aged in another one. And depending on the diameter of the salami, it takes a different amount of time. And so we said, why don't we see if we can figure out how to make a skinny salami that's in a shelf-stable variety pack with different types of meats. So we set about, and it took about 3 years to perfect that. And through our farmers markets, we, you know, test marketed to see what flavors and varieties were the most popular. And eventually we got down to six. And just this year, we started making the skinny salamis in brand new packaging.
Yeah, which, by the way, is a winner because there was a local product here called Ostrom that was a very big hit with the gym rats. And the one problem with it, I mean, it was certainly lower in calories and fat and so on, and it was an outlet for somebody who had a whole bunch of ostriches they couldn't get rid of. But the problem was they could never got the packaging to where it was really portable. I mean, you could open it. You'd have to carry scissors with you to open the packaging. And yours is simple.
That's certainly not going to work for any product that you want to get across the country. You have to make it easy for the consumer.
Yeah.
So we contacted a fantastic branding and graphic artist group that coincidentally and lucky for us was right here in metropolitan Washington, D.C. area in Virginia. And right off the bat, after we, you know, worked together on picking the designs, et cetera, we won in our very first year the 2017 Graphic Design Award for New Packaging.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was, we were very proud of that. And it's very different looking than the other products that are on the other meat snack products because our product's so different. We wanted to differentiate it with the packaging as well. So we did a lot of research and it took months to get that right, but we're very proud and we actually own our own packaging equipment and we make everything and do everything from scratch at our facility, our USDA facility right here in suburban Maryland.
Now you've got an authenticity component as well because the storage devices you're using, they came from the home of salumi, right?
Exactly. We got all of our equipment from the region called Umbria, which is known as Salami Central. In Italy, there are so many salami makers and makers of equipment. So we did our research as best as we could, and we found a company, and they actually came out, and we all worked together to install the equipment. And they have been out twice subsequently to enlarge our facilities.
Good. You're making a hit with this. So.
It's there's nothing like it. When people try this at trade shows in various places where we sample the product, they're actually surprised how good it is because they're so used to the taste of jerkies. And it's so far superior, really and truly, to the taste of other meat snack products that people actually surprise how good it is. And then they're really very pleasantly surprised. Unlike virtually every jerky on the market, we have zero carbs and zero sugar.
Right.
And jerky, if you look at almost every jerky's ingredient list, sugar is the second ingredient.
Yeah.
And we're basically just meat and seasonings. And that's it.
Yeah. My favorite was the lamb, actually.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's another thing that we did that's pretty much a trailblazing thing. most salamis, and with ours as well, are made with pork. And that's, of course, the traditional meat of making salamis. But we've decided not everybody eats pork, and just to have some different taste profiles, we would try making salami with both lamb and beef in addition to the pork. And so to our knowledge, we're the only people that are making a salami in the country with lamb.
Yeah, I think
and beef.
I think you're the only people between the UK and Italy, I mean the US and Italy as well, because I've never heard of
lamb jerky.
Lamb salumi. Yeah. In Italy. I mean, I guess the Italians don't like lamb all that well, and that's probably the reason why.
Well, it's pretty funny you said that, because we've actually brought back, so in addition to using different kinds of meats, the other thing that we do that's very different is, instead of having only a Italian traditional type flavor profile, we have a lot of out-of-the-box flavors. So we have traditional flavors that we make in our regular salamis. We have about 13 regular-sized salamis, and about half are traditional, about half are out-of-the-box. We have Indonesian flavor. We have Middle Eastern, North African. So we have all different kinds of flavor profiles, and candidly, we thought that was very important, because here in the United States, people love to try different things, and people are here from 180 different countries. So people are always interested in trying different flavors. In Italy, you know, people have passed down their, you know, ingredients and their seasonings from generation to generation. So for them, to be candid with you, they think this is heresy.
Yeah, I thought so. Kind of thing. I thought they might. Now, I'm a little bit surprised you don't have any Bambi in there.
No, we're staying away from that.
Okay.
No, we don't want to get sued by Disney either, so we're going to stay away from that.
Well, listen, there's one thing we need to know before we sign off, which is how you get some.
Well, thank you for asking. So right now, you could go to our website, meatcrafters.com, and we have a full line of regular-sized salamis and sausages, and duck breast prosciutto, my favorite child.
Oh, that would be good.
It's unbelievable.
I haven't tried that.
it's fantastic. Yeah. And you can order from there. And if you have any problems, you can just email us. We're happy to take care of it. The skinny salamis will be on Amazon probably next week.
Wow.
We were on Amazon, and then we switch to a new provider, and so we are relaunching on Amazon, and so probably next week people can go to Amazon.com and just put in skinny salamis and order it in any one of a number of different varieties.
Mitch, you're our hero.
Oh my goodness, I wouldn't go that far. I didn't find the cure for cancer. I'm just a cool product with my partners.
You might do that next. Nothing you do would surprise me.
Well, that's very kind, and I really thank you both for having me on your show, and wish you all the best, and I hope you your colds get better.
Well, I should be eating enough of that skinny salami to cure it.
There you go. Well, protein is a part of a good balanced diet, no question.
Okay, Mitch.
So there you have it. Something serious, something even more serious, something not so serious.
Well, it's serious. You
mean the skinny salami is serious?
Yeah, it was great stuff.
It was great stuff. All right, it was great stuff. And the other,
the
bread, and the crops for the future,
and forgotten
very important things. Yeah. We hope seriously that you'll look into this and give it some time and effort and energy, and we certainly intend to. And in the meantime, between now and next week, we'll be working away, creating another fascinating program for you. So until then,
bye-bye.